Welcome to Wild Hearts at Work, a podcast redefining our relationship with work through stories and conversations with wild hearts who have dared to challenge the status quo. And now, here's your host, Melissa Boggs.
Hello, friends, and welcome to this episode of Wild Hearts at Work. I am your host, Melissa Boggs, and our phrase this week is workplace hurt. Workplace hurt. And I'm really excited to bring my guest on today because she has some experience with this, I'd say both personally and professionally. And so who better to bring on and talk about this than Katie McLaughlin? Katie is a coach with a theater background, first of all. She provides leadership and culture transformation for startups. But as always, I'd rather have you tell us about yourself, Katie. So introduce yourself. Tell us about your work.
Hi, everyone. I'm glad to be here today. And through my business, McLaughlin Method, I am working with leaders and with teams to help change their culture. And I talk about how I'm on a mission to prevent or stop workplace hurt. And my business comes from my own experience where I worked in the startup world for a long time, very drawn in by the how, you know, kind of captivating the promises were of startup culture, that it was a family and, you know, we have all these perks and, you know, really take great care of our employees and our team and opportunity. And there's so many other, reasons. But what I found there was really the same problems and challenges that most workplaces have, where there are toxic leaders, some toxic cultures. And through that experience, I had many of my own experiences of being hurt in the workplace.
It's so interesting because, you know, when we were preparing for this podcast, we were talking about this idea and this concept of workplace hurt and how it's so easily dismissed, right? That, you know, well, it's just a job. Like, how can you get hurt? What do you say to people when they bring that up to you?
Well, some folks I think are like, wait, so do you talk about like workplace safety, like in manufacturing and you know, that kind of thing, right? But I'm really thinking about the kind of emotional and mental and, you know, often physical things that happen with burnout and with, again, those kind of toxic relationships. And most people that I speak to, when I use that phrase, workplace hurt, there's some kind of resonance with that phrase where people are like, yeah, I think I know a little bit of what you're talking about. But, you know, it's one of those things that usually is not marked by a major event. It's frequently a series of small things that happen over time that corrode a relationship. And we carry those with us from one workplace to the next. So if we had a boss who, you know, consistently expected perfection and maybe would frequently give negative feedback in front of a group, that would then cause some kind of hurt and potentially trauma. And then when you go into the next workplace, you might already have this kind of built up stress about presenting your work to this boss, whether or not it felt comfortable in a team meeting to present or show your work. And so you're already on edge, on eggshells, and now we've got to work back from that.
Absolutely. It reminds me of a model. I'll put this in the show notes, but the results pyramid, where at the bottom it talks about, you know, how our experiences inform our beliefs, which inform our actions, which inform our results. And that's exactly what you're describing. Do you think that leaders often take that into account, that like maybe the behaviors they're seeing aren't even a result of their own action, but like former workplace hurt?
No, I think most leaders are making the assumption that what you see is what you get, and that it's all happening or has happened as a result of someone being employed here. So like the clock starts when you join a company, and everything that happens is a result of that. When, you know, in reality, we're humans and our collective experience comes with us, and especially our baggage comes with us into new relationships, new workplaces. So I actually just recently published a blog called Is It Personal? And Why Workplace Hurt and Workplace Conflict Are Not All About You, and talked directly about this.
So I find it interesting that we seem to have accepted in the world that, like, things that happen to us in our childhood, whether they be positive or negative, you know, inform who we are as human beings now. But it seems so, you know, foreign to some that that same logic would apply to a job I just had 12 months ago. I mean, of course, you know, to us, we think, like, of course that's going to inform how I show up to work every day. So I find that really funny. So because that's such a foreign concept, I think that maybe we have a tendency to either hide some of that hurt from ourselves. And most certainly, you're not going to march into a new job in most cases and be like, hey, leader, I have a hard time giving presentations. So how do you in your work help them uncover and show to each other in the healthiest way possible, you know, what's going on underneath the surface?
So most of us aren't willing to, you know, most people shy away from confrontation, and the average person, I would say, would also like admit that, right? And because we have typically a hierarchy in most of our companies, most of our work relationships, especially the relationships we have with our leaders, that creates this implicit power relationship, this power dynamic. And frequently, that's also part of what adds to this workplace hurt. So because we've got this kind of uneven playing field, we have a variety of different skill sets in terms of communication, emotional intelligence, and being able to even articulate that emotional landscape, I have latched on to using my theater background and some of these theater exercises that I studied and wrote my thesis on back in school, called image theater. And it's an equalizer where you aren't using words. So it doesn't matter if you have the right language, but it's about using your facial expressions, your body language to create an image of a feeling, of a situation. And most frequently, I do this work in groups and with teams. So that way, everyone is responding to the same stimuli, even the leader. Because as a leader, you've had experiences of being led. And so you've had experiences where, you know, you might have been hurt or had fear going into a one-on-one or presenting something. And so through this, you don't have to know the right words to express, here's how I feel about this situation. And because we're bringing this theatrical component to it and taking the people out of that immediate situation where the trauma or hurt occurred, that's also allowing people to be a little more objective and be a bit more honest about their observations. Like, oh, I've seen this emotion before. This looks like fear, or this looks like frustration. And then we can start to have even playing field conversations about what we think is really going on.
Amazing. Does it always go as planned?
No. I mean, I always find that, you know, part of why I love doing any work with people is I find people extremely fascinating. And because of that, and there's humans in the room, just like live theater or any kind of live performance, things happen that you don't expect. You know, one of the workshops that I gave, we were less talking about very specific relationships and more we're looking at kind of the office environment in general, some of the archetypes that we typically see, like in a team meeting. And that evolved into this really powerful conversation about gender in the workplace and the expectations that we thought and we could assign to an image that we saw in this like kind of group of images where we had created this fake team meeting and had theoretically all these archetypes. When we replaced each of those individuals with someone of the opposite gender, our descriptions of those individuals changed. There's a lot that we don't realize is happening below the surface, frequently subliminally, just based on, you know, our experience of that person's gender, their body language, how they're showing up at work.
Wow. There's a little bit of like uncovering the unconscious bias there too. And like,
exactly.
That's absolutely going to be connected to hurt in the workplace. Wow. One of the things that's interesting to me is that we're so openly talking about workplace hurt. And I think we are able to do that now even differently than maybe even 2 years ago, right? Like it's something that is, we recognize as impactful and influential on the workplace. And because there's such a big discussion right now about what does a good workplace look like, or more succinctly, how do I, you know, retain talent is, let's get down to the brass tacks of it. Why do you think that is? Like, what is opening things up for people more? Is it the fact that there are people like you who kind of create an open space for that? Or do you think that we're just evolving now?
You know, even before the pandemic, and before the George Floyd murder and kind of the cultural awakening of 2020, people in the talent and people world, of which that's where most of my career has been, we're talking about DEI, you know, inclusion and belonging and happiness at work and all of those things we were talking about beforehand. And, you know, that with the pandemic and as everyone got kind of reoriented to kind of what's important, what does work even look like right now? All of those things are just becoming more and more important. And more leaders are experiencing this kind of self-awareness and this awakening to why that's so important. That said, there's still tons of leaders out there who, you know, think, oh, there's nothing wrong with, you know, with my organization, everything's great. And it's just that we're not paying people enough, right? Or something.
People don't want to work. I put that in quotes, everyone.
Right. I think that we've all felt a lot of things in the last few years. We've all had a lot more emotions, a lot more stress, burnout from all kinds of avenues. And so, you know, I think that's this perfect time about like what does a healthy workplace look like so that both the individuals and our people's needs can be met while also our business needs.
Absolutely. So let's go there. What does a healthy workplace look like? And more specifically, what have you seen as a result of some of your work? Like, what are some of your success stories and the things that make you smile when you're like, oh yeah, this organization is doing X now because they had this really impactful exercise with one another?
So, you know, a healthy workplace can vary quite a bit based off of, you know, kind of the personalities and perspectives that come into that culture. I think we kind of assume that a culture is static or a workplace, the feeling of working for a workplace is static, but it's ever evolving as the people who work there evolve because we each build and contribute to the culture of a company. And, you know, what I've found in many of my success stories is, and honestly, I didn't even realize this was going to necessarily be a big byproduct of the work that I do. But I've learned how much this work helps people to build empathy for their coworkers. You know, what I've seen, because I do surveys kind of before, after, and what I have seen is that at least 80%, if not more, of participants have at least a little bit more, if not a lot more, empathy for at least one person on their team. And I believe that every one of those relationships is part of how we get farther to a healthy culture. Now, building empathy, building emotional intelligence, building better communication skills, like those things don't happen overnight. They do take time to build over time. And so, you know, really some of the best results that I've seen have been with companies where I've worked with them month over month, and especially with a team cohesively month over month. And those teams, you know, I hear of them laughing together more. I hear of less conflict. You know, performance numbers go up. The longer data I get from working with a company, the better we can start to see that impact on tenure. Because sometimes it's a little too late. And so there's still going to be some tenure or some attrition after folks have worked with me. But we start to see, you know, those engagement scores go up for that team, and people feel more supported by their leaders and by their team overall.
I love that. So let's go back then, what's the opposite of that? Let's go back to talking about workplace hurt. Like, when you walk into an organization, and we're not going to name out any specific clients here, but what kind of things make you go, ooh, you know, I see trauma, like I can see it on them already. What are some of those signs?
So sometimes the signs are just in someone's body language, and how, you know, whether or not they look kind of withdrawn, are they participating in team meetings? Because the best results that I find come after I've had a chance to kind of observe them, I guess, out in the wild, you know, doing work together. And, you know, working one-on-one with folks, in addition to in a group, they will frequently share more openly about some of the challenges that they have experienced. But, you know, workplace hurt can take lots of different forms. And I know that that's part of why it's challenging for a leader to know what to do or even understand what's happening. You know, one of my experiences of workplace hurt was pretty early in my career. And I had experienced, you know, kind of repeatedly working really hard, making a difference, making an impact. My leader left, and, you know, I was kind of leading the team in their absence. And I wasn't even considered for the promotion to the other role. You know, I was immediately kind of dismissed. And so that felt like I was not being recognized for the work that I was doing. And even when I, you know, asked for a raise at review time, it was completely dismissed. And, you know, that feeling of your work not being validated or acknowledged, and really not having the recognition for the work that you've done, whether that's through pay, title, even just someone saying, hey, you did a great job, that corrodes over time. And so we start to lose faith in that organization's ability to change.
Well, and it also starts creating stories that you tell yourself, right? And it just, when you say corrode, I'm sure that's what you mean, but it's just like it snowballs to be so much more for many people than just the one thing that happened. And often it's not just that one thing either, right? Right. There's like a series of things that maybe culminated in that, you know, not like being passed over for promotion type of thing. What other things have you experienced? And you can speak more generally, but just that have impacted the way that you approach the world, and luckily you're self-aware enough to kind of overcome those. But how has that shown up for you personally?
Well, you know, I found that because of my own experiences of workplace hurt, and again, sometimes for me, that was also, you know, experiences of burnout, you know, a company just like kind of constantly pushing for results. And like, you know, it's couched in, under the phrase of like, oh, let's just like push this one time. But then we just keep pushing at that same level all the time. You know, I've had to do a lot of my own unpacking personally about my relationship with work. And because of a couple of these relationships were so hurtful, it really challenged my level of confidence on the work that I'm capable of. Because I've had a couple of leaders who, you know, gave such harsh feedback that felt personal. And it felt like it was not about my work and it wasn't about helping me do better. It was about tearing me down. And, you know, I'm proud to say that, you know, I've spent time in therapy and worked through that. I think everybody needs a therapist and a hug. But, you know, we all need that opportunity to try to heal from some of these traumas, or they will stay with us.
So we've been using both terms. We've been using the word workplace hurt and workplace trauma. Do you feel like those are interchangeable, or is there a difference?
I frequently think they're interchangeable, but I think when we use the word trauma, most people assume it's like capital T trauma, like something really big, really bad. And that's why I tend to use the phrase workplace hurt. But I'm trying to keep introducing that term trauma because it helps remind us how painful it is and how problematic it can be. So, because when we think about, you know, needing to go to therapy or needing to do work to overcome past challenges, you know, that is the result of typically some kind of trauma, some kind of repeated triggers. And these are the same kinds of things that we've been talking about workplace hurt. And, you know, really workplace hurt is the nicer way of saying workplace trauma.
Yeah, I totally agree. I completely agree. I think they are interchangeable, and yet trauma kind of does one of two things, actually. It can either bring attention to the seriousness of what you're talking about, or it can sort of trigger people and be like, you know, I mean, there's definitely this sense that how can you be hurt at work? And I think it goes back to that whole idea that I think is slowly becoming antiquated, that there is a difference between your workplace self and your home self, right? And so I'm curious your thoughts about that and how those things are connected when I'm just one human being, Katie.
Right, exactly. You know, and I think some of those notions, I love that you use the word antiquated because they're very dated. You know, I think it goes back to sometimes our, you know, our preconceived notions of work from like the 50s and 60s, you know, where there was more of this separation and, you know, people didn't take as much of their work home with them as they do today. And, you know, many of us have taken actual work home with us, right? And we working on our laptop and doing work. Now that most people are working remote still or hybrid, like, our work is literally at home. And so, of course, you know, you shut the door and nothing changes. There's still like, you know, laundry that has to be done. And like, you know, you're fighting with your spouse and, you know, your kids failing. Like, those are all things that are still happening. And just expectations as a society keep getting higher, right? Like, whether that's, you know, the relationship that we all have with our children, you know, what does a good relationship look like? You know, what does achievement or success look like? The bar keeps getting higher for many of us, especially I'd say in the US. And so, you know, I think it's time that we really, as a culture, accept that there's not a hard line. There is this blurred gray space between your personal life and your professional life. And all of that baggage that you have from your personal life is going to come into your work life and vice versa.
Absolutely. And even back to the idea that like our childhood still affect us. I mean, I know personally, I have moments at work that I know are showing up because of, you know, my relationships with my parents, whom I love, but, you know, we all have complicated relationships with the people in our lives. And I may behave a certain way because that's what was expected of me as a child. Like, that doesn't change because I either walked in the door of an office or, you know, logged onto a Zoom call. And, you know, to give this a positive spin, that can go multiple ways too. Like, if I was, you know, really praised for a certain thing as a child, I can bring that to the workplace and really shine in that area too. So it's all encompassing. But the idea that, you know, we are a different person at home versus at work versus being a parent. And not only is it that we're the same human, but we only have like so much capacity, like emotional capacity, physical capacity, et cetera, to bring to the whole table, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, talk about antiquated.
Well, and I like to encourage, you know, any leader and any individual, honestly, to just start to build the habit of observing yourself. And, you know, this is one kind of way that you can start to move the needle and maybe not get so, because I realize our conversation can be a little bit of a downer. But, you know, there are small things that you can start to do. One of those being like, notice before you're going to go in a meeting, how do you feel? Can you name that? And, you know, are you feeling stressed? Why? You know, starting to kind of get curious and get reflective about what you're feeling before you go into different conversations. And that can also help you make sure you set yourself up for success before you go into a challenging conversation at work. Maybe you need to practice with someone. Maybe you need to write out your thoughts or, you know, spend some time preparing for that conversation. So you can start to show up more authentically. You can start to be what I call a deliberate leader in the workplace by being intentional about how you want to show up instead of just showing up, you know, and just being reactionary. And the same can be used at the end of your workday, right? Like, if you had a crappy day, can you take a few moments to try to reset so that way when you go outside that door and you get to go back and see your family, that you're not bringing as much of that baggage from your day into your time with them?
You mean there's hope?
There is hope.
Yes. Yeah, I want to move into that for a minute, which is like, how do we go about healing some of that trauma, or at least like you just mentioned, noticing it. But I want to mention something really quickly. We talked about all these different, you know, whole human being, we're all one human being and we have limited capacity. And I just want to point out something that you kind of just brought to my forefront, which is that when you add on top of that, that you are a leader at work, not just, I don't mean to minimize whatsoever, but when you are responsible for the careers and in some cases, the emotions of other people, that's an entirely another layer that we're adding again to that one single human being. And I realize that like leaders have power and they have privilege, but I do think sometimes we forget that there is an added layer. I won't even call it a burden, but another piece that leaders have to manage along with all of the other things, you know, that are in their whole human being life. And that is that other people are depending on them. You know, it's not just managing their work. It's like we're expecting them to show up fully for their team and authentically. And that takes emotion and that takes effort and energy as well. So just wanted to add that because I feel like that's an important thing for us to acknowledge. So how do we heal this? So let's kind of dig into the good stuff here, the positive stuff, which is that there are ways through this. We've already mentioned therapy, and I just want to echo you. I have a therapist. I love my therapist. She calls me on my bullshit. And I personally have a tendency to intellectualize my feelings. And so I'll come to the table and say, like, this thing happened today at work. And, you know, this is how I felt, but this is probably why it happened. And back when I was a kid, but my amazing therapist will be like, well, that's nice. Do you actually want to talk about it now? Do you want to talk about how you feel? So therapy is one way. What are some other things that you see as like really good paths to healing some of this?
Working with a coach is also a really great way to help unpack that. So therapy and coaches can frequently be tackling the same kinds of things, but typically with a separate lens and different tactics. I've seen both. They're both wonderful and a really good investment. Many companies will now pay for a coach. So just a pro tip out there. So the next big thing is acknowledging what's in your control and what things you can only influence. So you can't actually control the actions, feelings, thoughts of another person.
Wait.
We just can't.
What?
Yep.
I have teenagers.
I know, right?
Like I can't even do that with my teenagers.
Nope. We can't. All we can do is influence them. And so what we can control is ourselves. We can control the language we use. We can control how we spend our time. We can control what workplace we work for, right? We can control whether or not we speak up, whether or not we take care of ourselves. Like those are all things that are within our control. And so you have to start there because it is the only thing you actually have control over. And, you know, the next piece is really about getting yourself more skills, whether that's skills in empathy and emotional intelligence and acknowledging and recognizing the emotions and experience of others. But most importantly, you know, I talk with every leader and anyone I can about the importance of rehearsing for reality. Why are we always going into a conversation that is high stakes, high emotion without practicing first? We're like, oh, we're just going to be off the cuff, like going to give someone feedback. No, maybe we should practice that. And that way we can get the bumps and bruises out. And as Brené Brown often says, our shitty first draft, we can get that out of the way. And then we can, you know, start to think about, well, how else do we want to show up with that person or with that team?
Well, and especially when it's your hurt that you're talking about, that you're bringing to the table, that you might have to, you know, be vulnerable and say, hey, you know, this is a thing that happened and I feel icky about it, you know, however we might want to put words around that. Do you find that practicing it ahead of time takes, I got to find a way to phrase this. I know sometimes when we say things out loud in a positive way, it sort of removes the power from it, right? Because we've said it out loud. Do you think that's a positive thing to rehearse that and maybe release a little bit of the pressure from that particular issue? Or could it potentially like take away the power of the moment, which as I say that out loud, I don't think so, but I want to ask you.
Yeah. You know, one thing that's interesting is that there's studies done on how, like, when we're sharing good news or an idea, that just sharing that idea and, like, getting positive, oh, that's a great idea, like, that gives our brain the right, like, brain chemicals that are equivalent to us actually achieving and doing that idea, which is, that's why some of us have a hard time with, you know, meeting our goals.
But I already said it. I already got the dopamine from it.
Exactly. you know, but we have to, the better that we understand a circumstance, a situation, the more comfortable and at ease we feel. And then we're not, you know, operating out of this fight, flight, freeze, you know, high adrenaline, high cortisol environment. You know, we see that with people who do public speaking. Right. I also can tell you that probably the first time I did a podcast, I was freaking out, you know, and now I've done a ton and it just feels like, you know, all right, I know how to do this. And so the more that we do things, the more comfortable and at ease we feel. And that's the biggest benefit of rehearsing.
Yeah, sure. And yeah, I don't think it takes the power out of it. I think it puts you in a position where you can be more in control of, you know, your articulation of the hurt. And I think by rehearsing, we have an opportunity to really explore what we want out of the conversation. Like, is it enough for me to just express, you know, the hurt? Do I need an apology from the, you know, am I, not that I can make it happen, but am I going to ask for an apology? Am I okay with not getting an apology? I mean, I think there's a lot that you can get from exploring it first with a trusted person, you know, with a coach or with your therapist, whichever it may be. You mentioned something about like fight, flight, fawn, freeze type of things. And we'd also talked about burnout. So without going too much down the the sad road again, I think there's an interesting thing to talk about there, which is that I don't think burnout is really what people think it is often. So how would you, if you were like going into a client, how would you talk to them about burnout and what it looks like and the effects that it has?
So in most workplaces, it's working too many hours at too high a pressure or too high a stakes for too long of a period of time. You know, I'd say that's kind of like the base definition of burnout. And for some companies, just realizing that and acknowledging like, well, how are our goals too aggressive? And, you know, not just are they too aggressive, but do we have backups? Do we have backup coverage, or do we have single points of failure in our ability to get certain things done? I'd say that was probably one of the biggest reasons why, you know, I experienced a lot of burnout, is that only I could do my job. There was no, you know, person I could hand something off to, you know, and so I wouldn't feel like, oh, I'm sick, I can't go into work. It was like, well, no, I have to make this happen. You know, and so that's one of the biggest things from a positive angle that leaders can start to look at and acknowledge that people get sick. You know, people's kids get sick. There are reasons why many of us need to take a break, you know, from the workplace, planned or unplanned. And so the better we have coverage and the more cross-trained folks are, the better we can still meet our goals while not kind of trampling all over our people.
Absolutely. The thing that stood out to me too, based on a definition similar, but a little additive that I've heard, was when you talked about pressure. There's a book, I'll put this in the show notes, Burnout: Unlocking the Stress Cycle. And the thing that was an aha moment for me in that book is she talks about the pressure part as being what's so important about, it's different, the difference between burnout or just simply being tired and like needing to take a vacation, right? The pressure is what like activates our nervous system. And again, you talking about like fight, flight, that's sort of what triggered this for me, which is that, you know, it's the constant pressure and like your nervous system being on edge that can create that burnout. And you have to heal that. Like, you have to calm your nervous system and tell your nervous system over and over that everything is okay, or you have to heal the trauma, like we've been talking about. And, you know, doing this work, doing the work that you do, is so important to kind of bringing all of that full circle and recognizing that it's all connected. If you feel like you have control over your work and you are in control of yourself, you know, there are some people who say, I don't always believe them, but I love my work and I like working 12-hour days. Okay, friend. But maybe it is true for some people, and maybe they don't burn out because they feel in control, like of themselves and their autonomy. But I think, you know, all of the things that you've been talking about, you know, using the theater exercises to kind of maybe reduce the vulnerability and let it come out a little bit, allows us to start healing those traumas. And the rehearsal allows us to calm our nervous system, so that maybe we don't create more trauma in that, you know, in that circumstance. I mean, all of it to me leads to preventing that burnout. Am I crazy?
You're not crazy. I couldn't have said it better myself.
No, I just feel like I'm kind of like connecting all the dots of everything you said. And it's just, yeah, it's really impactful to me. I feel like I had quite a bit of burnout in the latter part of the pandemic. I think all of us have to some degree. And it took me a while to realize the connection between trauma and that burnout, that it wasn't just that I was working too much, but under the pressure that you're talking about. So we're getting sort of toward the end of our time, and I have my two favorite questions that I always like to ask guests. The first one is, when you heard the name of the podcast, Wild Hearts at Work, what was the first thing that you thought of? How did it resonate with you, and what do you think that means?
It made me think of, first of all, just something kind of really like hopeful and happy, you know, kind of imagining people of all kinds, all shapes, you know, expressing themselves and being who they are. And, you know, when I think about the heart of people and, you know, it's hard not to think about love and, you know, feeling gratitude and hope. And so I'd say all of that, you know, kind of came together for me about, you know, thinking about, yeah, like that's a great aspirational thing to have at work.
Oh, well, we love that. One of my favorite, or one of my reasons for asking the question, is just that I think there are so many different types of wild hearts that are listening. And so I just imagine like us connecting each week to, you know, kind of the different definition that our guests bring. So thank you for sharing that. I have been super inspired by our conversation today. I feel like we could talk for two more hours. If others listening are also inspired, how can they find you? What do you have going on? Anything coming up that they need to know about? Yeah, tell them how to find you.
So you can reach me at my website, McLaughlinMethod.com. I'm also on LinkedIn, both personally, Katie McLaughlin, and my company, McLaughlin Method. And, you know, the best thing that I would say, there's two things I can offer listeners. First is that I have a free guide on how you can start to show your team that you're listening. So if you're a leader and you want to have some practical, tangible things you can start to do and know where to start showing your team that you're listening, I highly recommend you download that guide. We'll have a link to the download in the show notes. And then lastly, I do one-on-one individual, like a single session. So if anything that we've talked about today intrigues you and you want to dig in a little bit further, I have a discount for the first session. So you can get a taste of what that would be like to work together. And it's amazing the results you can get in just an hour together.
I'm going to have to think about that for myself. Well, Katie, thank you so much, not only for being here and just sharing your story and your thoughts and your experience, but also for the work you do, because that is the kind of work that makes it a place where we wild hearts can show up every day. So thank you so much all around.
Thank you. This has been great.
And to you, my friends, my wild hearts, thank you for listening again this week. We are getting to the end of season two. We have a few more episodes left to share with you, and they are going to be juicy ones. But I just am always appreciative and grateful that you come back every week. Please do like, share, subscribe, tell your friends who are also wild people at work. But until next time, dear hearts, stay wild.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Wild Hearts at Work. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share. For more resources and to connect with Melissa, visit melissaboggs.com. Also, if you or someone you know is doing great work in a wild way, get in touch about being a guest on the show. Until next time.